Hugh Bennett for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The cover story this week, Tear Down Town. Older homes are tumbling for swank new offerings, and a trend common inside the Beltline and in North Hills is surging to new areas. First, the Biz section. Biz is written and compiled by managing editor Dane Huffman. Museum of Art has big plans ahead. An upgraded amphitheater and enhancements to the part of the museum that faces the park are among the improvements at the North Carolina Museum of Art as an ambitious fundraising effort, or as part of an ambitious fundraising effort. The push was originally part of the museum's five-year strategic plan mapped out in 2020. We passed our strategic plan 5 minutes before the pandemic, joked Valerie Hillings, the museum's director. But, boosted by support from the General Assembly, the quiet phase of the $75 million effort began in earnest in the summer of 2022. Now, in the public phase, the museum is within roughly $10 million of its goal, Higgins said. A key component of the museum's plan is improving the amphitheater, which dates to the 1990s, by making it more accessible. The venue, officially the Joseph M. Bryan Jr. Theater, is closed for 2 years, while the museum improves restrooms, pathways, and visitor comfort. Connected to those upgrades is a significant revamp of the back of the original museum, now called the East Building. That's an important step in that the rear of the museum actually faces the popular open spaces behind it. Hillings envisions an upgrade that includes offerings such as coffee, a revamped back entrance, a pavilion that will make the space and entering the museum more inviting. The goal, she said, is to bring art, nature, and people together. The push comes at a time when the museum remains healthy. The facility is attracting 1.1 million visitors per year, Hilling said, and it relies on no federal funds for its $28 million budget. So at a time when many nonprofits are being whacked by federal cuts, NCMA is not. The effort also includes upgrading the museum's conservation efforts, enhancing the Winston-Salem campus, the former SECCA, now known as NCMA Winston-Salem, expanding public outreach projects, and continuing to upgrade the collection, especially with North Carolina artists. Community was really key, Hilling said. I really felt it was important to continuously think about multiple strategies to engage even more North Carolinians. Big day for Bailey's founder. A jewelry store that dates to 1948 celebrates a milestone June 21 when Ann Bailey, who opened Bailey's Fine Jewelry in Rocky Mount with her husband Clyde Sr., turns 100 years old. The store survived thanks to her efforts after Clyde Bailey died at the age of 46. Ann Bailey showed remarkable resilience and often speaks of how rivals were sure Bailey's would fail, but she had remarkable grit after growing up in the Oxford orphanage after her parents died. "It don't pay to underestimate some women," she once said. Bailey's now has multiple locations and even acquired a jeweler in Charlotte. "I love the jewelry business," Ann Bailey once said. "I loved helping customers, and I loved loading our store with beautiful jewelry. It's a remarkable birthday for a woman who has led an extraordinary life. I only have one speed, fast, fast, fast," she has said. "Sitting around just never suited me." Diced expands again, this time to Holly Springs. A local restaurant that started in Cary a decade ago is continuing to expand. Diced, with offerings that include salads, wraps, and grain bowls, has opened in Holly Springs. It's the fifth location for Diced. Michelle Woodward launched Diced in Cary on Kildare Farm Road in 2015 and later opened locations in Raleigh on Oberlin Road and downtown and also in West Cary. Holly Springs is rapidly growing, and more jobs are on the way as companies such as Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnologies adds jobs in the market. "This location is special, too, because we've been able to build out a full prep kitchen in the back, dedicated to making our cooked food and house-made dressings fresh every single day for all five locations," Woodward said. At Seaboard Station, a popular Charlotte spot is headed to Raleigh. The Common Market, a deli, bar, and retail shop with locations in Charlotte and Durham, will open at 807 Halifax Street at Seaboard Station in Raleigh next spring. The first common market opened in 2002 in Charlotte's Plaza Midwood neighborhood and now has three locations in Charlotte and jumped to Durham in 2023. Graham Worth, who's from Raleigh, joined the company in 2016 as a majority partner. Under an LLC, Worth purchased the parcels at 801 and 807 Halifax for $2.8 million in July. It's a cool, eclectic spot that is what we target for our brand, Worth said. And finally, a hotel with a rooftop bar to rise near RDU. Another hotel is planned near Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Wynwood Hospitality Group of Raleigh has filed plans to build a 235-room hotel at 10100 Lumley Road, where Interstate 540 and Lumley Road intersect just north of the airport. The hotel would be seven stories and 158,662 square feet. Wynwood owns the vacant 5.93-acre parcel. The total assessed value of the land is $1.8 million, according to Wake County records. We'll turn now to the reporter pages before we get to the cover story. The first reporter page is Aviation and Innovation, and it's written by Lauren Onasorge. Raleigh tech firm files for bankruptcy liquidation. A tech company in Raleigh that had shown signs of promise is now sinking in debt. EDJX has filed for bankruptcy liquidation, listing more than $9 million in debts and just $10,000 in assets. The Edge Computing Company, founded in 2018, had raised nearly $30 million over the years, but it couldn't pay back mounting debt, leaving investors and former executives with substantial unpaid claims. Exactly what went wrong is unclear. Most people who had been associated with the company either couldn't be reached for comment or declined to talk about the situation. Some cited non-disparagement contracts. The Chapter 7 liquidation petition was signed by Michael Preston. According to the filing, he's owed more than $562,000 in wages owed, that's a quote, since late 2022. Preston's LinkedIn page indicates he left his full-time position as chief financial officer at the company in 2023. Preston could not be reached. EDJX is being represented by attorney Jason Hendren of Hendren, Redwine, and Malone, who couldn't be reached for comment. Mitch Mumma, an investor through InterSouth Partners, said the company ceased operation in January of 2023 because it lacked sufficient funding to continue. He declined further comment. The top story in this section, New Deal Fuels Aerospace Hopes. North Carolina is back in Paris, and this time with a Jet Zero win. At the 2019 Paris Air Show, North Carolina officials struck up conversations with the vice president of an aerospace giant. Those initial talks blossomed into Pratt & Whitney's 800 jobs, $650 million investment in Asheville. This month, economic development officials in North Carolina are again flying high after aircraft startup Jet Zero picked Greensboro for a manufacturing site that could someday support thousands of jobs. Now, economic development and state officials are once again in Paris for the aviation industry's annual event that runs June 16th through 22. The group includes Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, who said aerospace has been a key target ever since EDPNC was established a decade ago, and Lee Lilly, the state's Secretary of Commerce. The reason that you go is that it's difficult to impossible to find another environment that's so concentrated with senior executives from the aerospace community, Lilly said. It's every major aerospace company and their suppliers. It comes right after Jet Zero announced it would create 14,500 jobs by 2036, a record for the state. It's a great tailwind for sure, Chung said. Chris Johnson, Economic Development Director for Johnston County, calls Jet Zero a generational opportunity for North Carolina that could impact Johnston County. I can see ancillary jobs and industries needing to be within a two-hour drive to this location, of which Johnston County falls well within that ring, he said. Matt Gladick, Vice President of Economic Development for the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, said, a company building aircraft will need lots of small parts and services, and our current businesses will have an advantage of winning those subcontracts just based on our location. In Chapel Hill, a Charlotte firm makes play for Triangle Wealth. A growing wealth management firm in Charlotte has acquired a Maryland company, giving it an instant Triangle foothold thanks to a Chapel Hill location. Strathmore Capital Advisors of Charlotte has acquired New Potomac Partners, a firm based in Maryland but with a Chapel Hill office. That office alone has close to $70 million in assets under management, and that clinched the deal, Strathmore executives said. John Charles Kernodle, president of Strathmore, said the plan is to seek out additional deals in the Triangle. Research Triangle, Raleigh, Chapel Hill, Durham is a big market in the state, and we're really excited about our vision of finding other great advisors, he said. Rapid Scale eyes Raleigh expansion. Rapid Scale is expanding in Raleigh. The question is where? A possible spot is the 8th floor of 421 North Harrington Street in Kane Realty's Smoky Hollow development. A permit application with the city indicates the firm is planning to upfit the full floor, nearly 24,000 square feet of space. While the company confirms that it has filed papers to upfit the office, Rapid Scale has not signed a lease, according to a spokeswoman. We have not signed a lease in Smoky Hollow and are only in the exploratory phase for finding additional office space, C.G. Townsend said. Claudette LeBlanc, chief operations officer, said Rapid Scale has zero plans to vacate its current space in the 301 Hillsborough Tower. We expect to add more local talent in the future, so we have explored several spaces in the immediate area, including but not limited to Smoky Hollow, she said. Kaylee Thompson is the writer of the Real Estate and Development section in the TBJ. Raleigh spot marred by fire hits market. A downtown Raleigh site ravaged by fire could see new life as the area around it builds up. Three lots along the northern gateway into downtown are on the market as the owner, the North Carolina League of Municipalities, is looking for a development buyer or development partner. The two-acre property, including 215 North Dawson Street and 300 and 308 West Jones Street, is primed to be turned into a mixed-use development up to 40 stories. There is no listing price for the property. NCLM officials declined to say how much they are looking to get for it. In June 2024, the North Carolina Department of Transportation spent $12.52 million on a one-acre parking lot in the Warehouse District. Billy Redmond of Trademark Properties, which is listing the property, said NCLM wants to see a project rise that would benefit the community. A 2017 fire damaged the buildings on the site, leading to NCLM tearing them down. In January 2024, the property was zoned for up to 40 stories. Listing documents state, quote, while the league is not focused on leading the planning, execution, and delivery of a high-rise project in downtown Raleigh, they remain very interested in occupying space in the building for their offices, unquote. RTP plans clear crucial hurdle. A crucial step has been taken in the process to remote more live-work-play environments in Research Triangle Park, a move that could lead to a sweeping makeover of the area in the years ahead. On June 16th, Wake County Commissioners unanimously approved amending RTP's zoning district to allow for RTP 3.0. With the approval from Wake County, the allowed uses in the county's portion of RTP will expand to include residential and non-research commercial. The Research Triangle Foundation's vision is to transform the park from a sprawling group of office campuses and research and manufacturing hubs into a more livable community with a mix of housing, retail, entertainment, and offices. The Hub RTP development, a.k.a. RTP 2.0, taking shape between Highway 54 and Interstate 40 at Davis Drive, is the first major piece of the puzzle. RTP straddles Wake and Durham counties. About 27% of the land is in Wake County. While getting the approval from Wake County was key, the RTF also needs to receive approval from the Durham County Board of Commissioners. There's no date set for the case to go before the Durham Board, but the goal is to have the approval in hand by the end of 2025. The final step in the process is for the Owners and Tenants Association and the RTF Board to vote on adopting the policies and procedures associated with the new zoning rules and allowances. Scott Levitan, CEO and President of RTF, said the plan is to have RTF's vote coincide with the vote in Durham County. We want to be very thoughtful about making sure the reason why companies chose to be in RTP, that those reasons remain valid. We don't want RTP 3.0 to be the impetus for companies saying, now RTP isn't a place where I want to do business, Levitan said. Boston developer sells Raleigh site. Plans for a stalled development in downtown Raleigh appear to be officially scrapped as the developer has sold its property. The Fallon Company of Boston sold the two lots that had been flagged for the second phase of Raleigh Crossing on Hillsborough Street. The lots at 309 and 327 Hillsborough Street sold for $6.8 million, according to Wake County deed records. R.E. Dunn Industrial, LLC, owned by Matt Stevens, acquired the lots. The first phase of Raleigh Crossing was the 19-story 301 Hillsborough Tower. Chester Allen of CBRE said he alerted Stevens to the off-market opportunities and advised him to invest because of the growth in the Hillsborough corridor. Allen said Stevens bought it as an investment, as a 1031 exchange, and has no immediate plans for it. Stevens is an industrial developer behind a handful of projects. The two lots total 0.79 acres and hold a parking lot and vacant office building. The combined assessed value of the properties is $13.2 million. And finally, in this section, a 55-plus community plan for West Cary. An Ohio developer is moving forward with plans for an age-restricted community in West Cary, where development continues to heat up as land becomes scarce. Epcon Communities closed on the purchase of two properties for its next 55-and-up residential community. It paid $5.9 million for 50 acres north of Green Level West Road, according to Wake County deed records. The company will close on the third parcel later this year and expects to move forward with construction in January of 2026. The project, called Courtyards at Jacobs Creek, will have 167 lots, 28 townhomes, and 139 single-family homes. Listing prices are estimated to start in the mid-$400,000s for the townhomes and the high-$400,000s for single-family homes. Zach Ezone brings us the healthcare and life sciences section. Former PPD exec lands CEO role at Fortrea. A multi-billion dollar public company based in Durham has selected a new CEO amid a slumping stock price. Fortrea has named Anshul Thakral its next chief executive about a month after Thomas Pike stepped down. Thakral will take the helm August 4th. He joins Fortrea from Launch Therapeutics, a Boston company he co-founded. Prior to Launch, Thakral was previously the chief commercial officer at Wilmington-based PPD. Fortrea formed in 2023 when Burlington's LabCorp spun off its clinical development business. Since then, the company, which operates as a contract research organization, has underperformed financially, and its stock price has fallen around 80%. I'm confident this company can execute on its patient and customer-focused mission while delivering profitable growth, which ultimately delivers value for shareholders, Thakral said. Thakral will earn an annual base salary of $1.1 million, plus an annual bonus of 150% of this base salary, depending on certain short-term corporate and individual performance goals. He's eligible for performance-based awards that tie a significant portion of his compensation package to, quote, building stockholder value of performance, unquote, according to a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Duke expands medical campus in surging Cary. Duke Health is expanding its medical campus in one of the fastest-growing areas of Wake County. The health system is building a new facility that will add hospital services to its 85-acre campus off Green Level West Road in Cary, west of Highway 540. The campus currently houses about 100,000 square feet of primary care, pediatric, urgent care, and some specialty services. With this expansion, Duke is adding an emergency department, a small number of inpatient beds, and other services. This includes cancer care, imaging, infusion, surgical services, and gastrointestinal endoscopy. Duke expects to complete the building housing these services in 2027. The campus is in a fast-growing area known for attracting affluent families and young professions. Maybe they meant professionals, but it says young professions. Duke officials said the objective is to bring more healthcare services closer to where patients live. This next phase of the campus provides a convenient option for emergency and inpatient care, said Chief Strategy Officer Morgan Jones. We envision adding more specialized services in the future to round out the needs of the local community. Duke in 2016 began acquiring land to build out the campus. In 2022, the health system opened its first clinics at the site. This expansion is part of the system's broader plans for the campus, which will eventually include a large acute care hospital. Duke has already secured approval from state regulators for 40 hospital beds at the campus. The health system in April filed a building permit application with the town of Cary for the construction of a, quote, micro hospital, unquote. This application followed Duke last year filing a development plan for the next phase of construction on the campus. More recently, Duke secured access to more than $500 million from the issuance of bonds, with a portion of the funding supporting the Cary campus. Cary now has a population of more than 180,000, which is double the 95,000 people it had as recently as 2000. Cary's population as recently as 1990 was only 44,000, which is smaller than Wilson is today at 47,000. National Resilience may leave Durham facility. A biomanufacturing company is evaluating its space needs as it streamlines operations amid shrinking demand, raising questions about the future of its Durham facility. California's National Resilience says it is reevaluating its manufacturing facility at 1733 TW Alexander Drive as it closes other facilities around the country. The move follows the company in January disclosing plans to lay off 120 employees at the Durham facility. The company on June 16th said it was beginning a legal process to wind down operations at several underutilized sites, but the Durham site is not among that group. As part of advancing our transformation efforts, we're exploring a sale of our Durham RTP site, a company spokesperson said in an email. The RTP facility is not included in the legal proceedings, and there are no current changes to RTP's operations. Property records show the nearly 97,500-square-foot facility is owned by Oxford Property Group, which acquired it in early 2022. Deed records show National Resilience has a lease agreement with Oxford Property Group through 2037. The facility was built in 2015. The Greater Triangle section of the TBJ is brought to us by Ben Tobin. In Granville County, a lawsuit puts housing developments in limbo. Potential developments that could lead to thousands of new homes hang in the balance as Granville County has sued the Oxford over its rezoning process. Granville County government said in a lawsuit filed in Granville Superior Court June 11th that the city has improperly and illegally rezoned property under the county's jurisdiction on two occasions over the past 4 months. The county said the city has violated state law by making rezoning decisions before annexing them into the city. Oxford Mayor Guillermo Nurse and City Attorney Tom Burnett declined to comment. The rezoning decisions by the Oxford Board of Commissioners could add more than 3,000 housing units to the municipality. On February 11th, the commissioners approved conditional rezoning for roughly 409 acres off Landis, Salem, and Tabbs Creek Roads, known as the Hunt Landis Development. On April 15th, they approved conditional rezoning for Perry Farm, a project on more than 427 acres off Perry Road. The lawsuit states that Oxford acted beyond its authority. According to the state statute in question, which is 160D-204, acceptance of jurisdiction, adoption of development regulations, and decision on development approvals may be made concurrently and may have a common effective date. In Pinehurst, club plans $1 million homes. Million-dollar homes are planned for a private country club community in the Pinehurst area. Pine Wild Country Club is planning a 77-home luxury neighborhood called Azalea Place, with home sales set to begin in September. The homes will feature seven floor plans ranging from 2,600 to 3,800 square feet, with prices starting slightly north of $1 million. We're really revitalizing the community as a whole, said Albin Terry, executive project director for Pine Wild Builders. We're expecting sort of a mix of retirees, of folks who may be looking for a second house in the Pinehurst area, and some folks in the existing Pine Wild community who may want to downsize a little bit and get something newer. Pine Wild Builders, a division of Pine Wild's owner 1E Homes Clubs and Resorts, is leading the project. Terry said this is the first project of its kind in Moore County in more than a decade. Pine Wild Country Club was sold for about $20 million in late 2023, and a string of investments has followed. In April, the Pinehurst Village Council voted to approve a major site plan for Pine and Wild. The approved plan includes an expanded clubhouse, addition of a fitness center, and an expansion of parking spaces from 116 to 318. The clubhouse renovation is described as an $18 million project. Pine Wild is just west of Pinehurst Resort and is surrounded by a gated residential community covering around 2,000 acres. The initiation fee is $40,000, according to a membership pamphlet. Pine Wild's first golf course, the 18-hole Magnolia course designed by Gene Hamm, came online in 1989. The club has two other courses, the 18-hole Holly course designed by golf legend Gary Player, and a 9-hole par 3 course, Azalea, designed by Bill Sessoms. In Johnston County, move over barbecue and make room for chicken salad. A trendy chicken salad chain is set to make its debut in Smithfield. Chicken Salad Chick opened June 18th at 924 North Brightleaf Boulevard in Smithfield, according to the company. Husband and wife duo Heather and Clay Harmon will be the franchise owners. This will be the first Chicken Salad Chick location in Johnston County. Scott DeVinny, CEO of Chicken Salad Chick, said he is bullish on the growth of the market. Smithfield has experienced significant growth in recent years, with Johnston County ranking among the fastest-growing counties in the state. DeVinny said in a release, despite this momentum, the area still lacks a variety of dining options. And in Chatham County, developers expand project with land buy. One of the biggest projects in Chatham County is pressing ahead as the developer acquires more land and embarks on a new phase of work. Charlotte real estate firm Beacon Partners purchased more than 24 acres off NC 751 in Western Apex for more than $6.7 million this month, according to Chatham County deed records. The price is about $280,000 an acre. The property is adjacent to land Beacon Partners has acquired over the years and will be part of Apex Gateway, a 380-acre commercial and industrial development. Walker Gorham, managing partner for Beacon Partners, said, "We are in the process of delivering our sixth building on site and now have over 1 million square feet of life sciences and distribution space leased at the project." The next phase of development will be along Highway 751 and features two Class A plus light industrial facilities totaling 398,000 square feet, Gorham said. Let's turn now to the cover story. Street by street, knockdown trend accelerates and your neighborhood could be next. Kaylee Thompson is the author of the cover story this week. Driving north on Yadkin Drive in Raleigh, one can see a pattern of ranch homes built in the 1960s, dotted between modern brick mansions, a jarring dichotomy and symbol of change as the number of homeowners selling has increased. Yadkin, in the heart of the North Hills neighborhood, is one of many streets in the neighborhood undergoing this transformation. Northbrook Drive and Currituck Drive have been particularly targeted as the neighborhoods sitting north and northwest of North Hills' main district see more and more people choosing to live in the desirable and walkable area. Mid-century modern homes sitting on large lots are being sold, demolished, and replaced by massive custom homes. It's a bit reminiscent of the Little House book by Virginia Lee Burton, where a small home gets squeezed by an increasingly larger development that surrounds it. While this isn't a new phenomenon in Raleigh, the trend is creeping beyond the Beltline. The neighborhoods immediately surrounding North Hills are experiencing a wave of teardowns at a rapid pace, specifically Meadow Hill Place and Stratton Park, home to North Hills Club and North Hills Park. And it's not stopping there. This teardown trend is accelerating, jumping beyond North Hills and inside the Beltline and sweeping across the Triangle. Johnny Chappell, real estate developer and broker, said areas like Northeast and Northwest Raleigh, along with Southwest Raleigh and heading toward Cary and Apex, are starting to see this same phenomenon of older homes disappearing. Northclift, a neighborhood closer to Shelley Lake with homes from the 1970s, has had its first home demolished and replaced, according to Jim Allen, CEO of the Jim Allen Group. Allen predicts that will start to happen more in that neighborhood and continue to expand outward. As Chappell noted, we're taking older housing stock that's been really reached the end of its functional lifespan and replacing it with new housing stock that will hopefully last several more decades to come. Driving this is a variety of factors. One is the sheer cost of renovating and adding on to an older home. Another is the triangle continues to attract people from places such as the West, Northeast, and Florida who are selling high-priced homes and can spend millions on their new home here. And the more a street sees massive homes rise, the more likely it is that others will follow. Doug Green, managing partner of Tobacco Road Custom Builders, said many streets have reached the point where half of the homes were built in the last 10 years, and that steady procession of $2 million homes is what's driving a lot of the value up. The mid-century ranches in these neighborhoods are now selling for upward of $700,000, an incredible price jump from around $400,000 5 years ago, as the only thing that has changed is the value of the land. Allen said that the value of the property varies and that when it comes to the neighborhoods surrounding North Hills' main district, it's street by street. The closer the home is to the amenities of North Hills, the higher the value. The least expensive one that sold in the last year was about $425,000, and the most expensive one that sold in the past year in North Hills so far was $1.4 million. So it's everything in between, and each street has a different value. The closer you are to Harris Teeter in North Hills, the more expensive your lot is, Allen said. Linwood's the most valuable street so far in North Hills, and it's a block from Harris Teeter. But there are very few lots left on that street. The first lots we bought over there, we bought in the $400,000 range, and now those lots sell for $1 million. Aside from the rising development in North Hills and all it has to offer, Green attributes the rise in property values to the tear-down and rebuild craze. The one thing a lot of people fail to look at a lot of times, because there are pros and cons to all that development, but the teardowns and the rebuilds of new custom homes are part of what's helped everybody's property values go up, Green said. Some people are going to take a look at that and say, well, you made my tax value go up, so that's a nuisance or that's an added expense for my family, and we don't plan on moving from our ranch. We love our ranch and we're going to keep it up. But at the same time, that still brings value at some point. If you had a ranch house that was worth $400,000 9 years ago, and now it's worth $1 million, that's equity in your home, and that gives you some security as a family. So when a new home buyer comes into the neighborhood and buys a ranch, the initial cost in the process may be around $800,000. After that is demolition, and how heavy the house is determines how much it will cost to demolish. If the house is mostly made of brick and has a concrete slab basement, it's going to cost significantly more than a simple wood frame home. Demolition can range from $15,000 to $40,000, according to Green and Dean Sackett, president of Homestead Building Company. The permitting process for demolition can add more to it, but it's minimal compared to the actual cost of disposing of the physical home. The final step in the cost process is dependent on the buyer and what they're looking to have in a home. Because of the size of the lots in these neighborhoods, the homes built typically range from $1 million to just over $2.5 million. But a lot of that depends on packages buyers select and how far they decide to go with custom elements. One reason the new homes end up being so large is due to the need to make the deal make sense financially. If a developer spends $800,000 or more on a lot, then the square footage of the house needs to be higher so the price per square foot pencils out. Green said banks won't fund construction loans for homes that are 2,500 square feet because the price per square foot is too high. That means the appraisal value won't match because it will be far above market value. Therefore, the size of the home has to increase and the neighborhood sees 3,800 square feet to 7,000 square foot homes pop up, hence the massive mansions on half-acre lots next to small ranches on the same lot size. So why not just remodel and add on to these older homes? Why do all the work of permitting for demolition and the cost associated? Sackett says most of the time it's just not feasible. To bring an older house up to snuff, expenses can add up quickly, from paying for necessary repairs to replacing dated and dangerous infrastructure to adding on at least 2,000 square feet. It becomes a long and costly process. Green says that for just an addition to the house, it can run anywhere from $275 to $400 per square foot. That means a 2,000-square-foot addition could cost around $800,000. Factoring in repairs and infrastructure replacement, the amount can grow to more than $1 million. despite high demand for people wanting to move to the neighborhoods north and northwest of North Hills Main District, it's not exactly the typical neighborhood when it comes to real estate values. When owners do choose to sell their mid-century homes, if they list it with a real estate agent and put a for sale sign in the yard, it could sit there for months with no bites. That's because buyers don't want to be the ones who go through all the work of purchasing, demolishing, and building a new home. It's too much money and too much of a hassle. Instead, sellers choose one of two options: contact a home builder or realtor to see if they're interested in buying their home, or respond to the multiple inquiries they've likely received over the years from home builders offering to buy their home. Allen, who has bought, demolished, and rebuilt more than 500 homes since 2007, said that the majority of sellers know their house will be demolished. Chapel said some of these homeowners have been getting offer letters in the mail for the past 10 years, and most of the transactions are happening before the property ever sees the MLS. Of course, that's a sign of the high interest in people wanting to live in the area, and a buyer's risk goes down when several people are interested. North Hills, North Ridge are two communities that you are lowering the risk profile when you're taking on by building a new home. So yes, the cost of entry is higher, but the risk associated with being there is lower because so many people want to be there, Sackett said. It's lower just because so many people are still in line behind you. So if life takes a turn in the forever home that you think you've moved into, is it your forever home? There's going to be somebody else who wants it. So just who are these people buying million-dollar homes on half-acre lots? Chapel says most of them are relocation buyers who are coming from other states that historically have higher home values. People coming from New York, California, Washington, D.C., Illinois, and Florida are seeing a substantial decrease in the amount they must spend for a high-end home. The remaining buyers are move-up buyers and growing families with elementary-age children who are drawn to the walkability, the good schools, and all the shopping, dining, and entertainment that North Hills Main District offers. With these homes ranging from 3,000 to 7,000 square feet, Sackett said these buyers are looking for several factors to be on the first floor. That includes the owner's suite, a guest suite, and an office/study. Not to mention, since COVID, home buyers have placed a higher importance on outdoor living space. Home builders in the North Hills neighborhoods are including features like porches, patios with fireplaces and seating areas, fire pit, a small yard, hot tub, and swimming pool, a big change from the previous area of basketball goals and chain-link fences. With this tear-down trend picking up and spreading beyond the Beltline, does this mean the death of older homes? Absolutely not, Sackett said, because there are permitting restraints, there are topography restraints on the lot. Those two come together and mean that there are some homes that will never disappear because either current permitting requires things that are so different on that lot than they were 60 years ago that you just can't afford to build on it. Since not all of the older homes inside the Beltline can or will be torn down, that means builders will get even more creative and push to areas further out, like north of the Beltline and southwest Raleigh and Wake County, as Chapel mentioned. Allen said he is doing teardowns and new builds in neighborhoods close to North Hills, such as Quail Meadows and Fairfax Hills, along with all the way from Falls of the Neuse to inside the Beltline. This is especially true because lots with ranches on them are already serviced by water and sewer and typically have better topography than an undeveloped lot. Plus, the amount of time it takes to tear down and build new is significantly shorter than filing plans, going through permitting, and building on raw land. The majority of subdivisions that take place in the Triangle right now take between 3.5 to 4 years to actually have lots hit the ground, whereas you can do one of these within a year, Allen said. Because you've got reasonably flat lots for the most part, especially if you're buying one of these big old ranches that had to be on a wide lot to begin with, and now you're getting not only a wide lot, I'm getting one that already has water and sewer available to it, and you can build a very nice home back on it. For some, watching homes from a bygone era of shag carpet and avocado washing machines get torn down can be painful. But the aging infrastructure and wiring combined with the value of the land has created a recipe for bigger homes to rise. The lack of undeveloped land is also contributing to a trend that will only grow. We don't have an infinite supply of land here, Chapel said. We continue to have more people who want to live here, which is a good thing. And so builders and developers have to become a little bit more creative in terms of finding new opportunity to build. That's kind of where we are, where Raleigh doesn't have an infinite supply or a long runway of available property in certain areas. This week's Viewpoint article is written by frequent contributor John Hood. AI will aid transit, not transform it. Artificial intelligence is coming to public transit. In fact, in some functions and places, it's already here. But can AI elevate transit into a major mode of daily travel in North Carolina cities and towns? Sorry, no. You don't have to be a technologist to recognize that autonomous vehicles, AVs, are inevitable. Self-driving cars get the most headlines for understandable reasons, but I'm persuaded that automating truck, bus, and train routes will happen faster in a manner that will save time and money while also satisfying safety concerns. AVs cannot as yet consistently navigate pedestrian-heavy street grids. Their initial deployment to scale will likely occur along fixed routes, including inner-city passenger and freight service. Writing in City Journal, economics editor Jordan McGillis observed that such uses won't eliminate driving as an occupation. Instead, humans will handle operations near origins and destinations where the irregularities of tight city streets, loading docks, and warehousing demand a flexible mind. He wrote, in practice, this will mean men who previously would have been isolated on the highway for hours on end are instead able to move freight closer to home. Some transit vehicles will become autonomous as well, and future iterations may well include Waymo-style vans and shuttles. More immediate are AI applications that optimize routes, signals, and back-office support for human-operated buses. Some transit systems are already using them. We should welcome such innovations in North Carolina. They'll save money and improve service, but I remain doubtful their effects will include significant increases in the share of North Carolinians who regularly use transit for commuting or other daily tasks. Charlotte has by far the state's most elaborate and costly transit system, including rail and streetcar lines. A bill filed this year in the General Assembly would place a 1 cent hike in the sales tax on the Mecklenburg County ballot this fall. Public transportation would get 60% of the revenue. Even so, its buses and trains are already running well below current capacity, with ridership only 65% of what it was before the COVID pandemic and about half of what it was in 2013. In Raleigh, transit accounted for 2% of daily commutes in 2019. 4 years later, it was just 1.2%. Yes, many fewer people commuted alone in their cars in 64% than in 2019, which then 78%, but that's because a quarter now commuted virtually by working from home, compared to 9% in 2019. Heck, more Raleigh residents now walk to work than take a bus. Although technology-driven improvements in transit service may budge these numbers a little bit, the blunt truth is that the vast majority of us will always choose personal automobility or work flexibility, if applicable, over riding in groups on someone else's schedule. That doesn't mean transit will or should disappear, however. Outside of a few highly dense markets such as New York and Washington, transit's primary function is to provide essential mobility services for those who cannot drive or afford their own vehicles. AVs and AI applications will help us better and more economically meet their needs. That's fantastic news and no fantasy. John Hood is a John Locke Foundation board member in Raleigh. He can be reached at jhood, that's just the letter J, H-O-O-D, at John Locke, and Locke is spelled L-O-C-K-E, .org. We've got time for this week's Project Life story, which highlights executive health and worker wellness in the Triangle. This story this week is written by Connie Gentry. She makes the case for ergonomics. Tech neck and hot desking are impacting worker productivity, and ergonomist Mindy Smith is on a mission to mitigate those risks. Repetitive motion takes a toll on workers' health, and those that occur while the worker is predominantly sedentary are among the most taxing. Work-related musculoskeletal disorders, that's WMSDs, which include anything from vibration-induced injury that result from riding a forklift to chronic back pain from climbing in and out of a truck, are on the rise. The most visible and nearly ubiquitous WMSD has become tech neck or text neck, which is the strained posture created by the forward flexed head and neck position most people adopt when looking down at electronic devices. Recent studies from the National Institutes of Health conclude that spending 3 hours a day on mobile phones is a significant risk for causing tech neck. Last year, half of the U.S. population spent considerably more than that, averaging 5 to 6 hours a day on their smartphones. That's often in addition to the time spent staring at work screens. Neck pain has become prevalent, an increasing deterrent to productivity and cause for ergonomic assessments. Since founding her practice, Raleigh's Ergo Smith Consulting in 2008, certified ergonomist Mindy Smith has seen an evolution as people work differently than in years past and companies become more attuned to employee wellness and safety. Things have become more proactive. In the beginning, employers were just responding to injuries. We'd get called because there was carpal tunnel syndrome in one area of a factory. Now we're doing more employee education, she said. Previously, the focus was on office workplace evaluations. Now, Smith is increasingly called out to train health and safety personnel on how to recognize and address ergonomics-related hazards. The best way to prevent injuries is when employees are aware of ergonomics and report symptoms early before they have an injury, she said. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that WMSDs can significantly reduce worker productivity and impact morale, and they're among the costliest work-related injuries. The median number of days out of work for a WMSD is 14, compared to an average of 9 missed days for other work-related injuries. Smith explained that the problem is not just absenteeism, but also presenteeism. That's when you're at work but not fully functioning, and there's a huge cost to that. People want to be present, but different physical or mental health issues may make it very difficult to be present in the moment. In doing ergo assessments, Smith encounters a range of challenging work environments, from clean rooms in a laboratory setting to utility crews working outdoors after a storm. Stephanie Glasgow, Director of Human Resources at the Orange Water and Sewer Authority, that's OWASA, said Smith has done ergonomic and safety assessments for several of the more than 135 people working at OWASA, which has offices as well as water and wastewater treatment facilities with people sitting at desks, driving vehicles, and doing a range of physical labor. When we bring Mindy in for an assessment, she's making sure our folks are as comfortable and as safe as they can be to prevent those musculoskeletal injuries. We have a lot of large equipment, big dump trucks and backhoes. Getting in and out of that type of equipment can put a lot of stress on people's backs, Glasgow said. The organization hosts an annual safety summit for all its employees and ergonomic workplace assessments whenever they indicate a need. Mindy makes her recommendations about equipment and spacing, what's to your left and what's to your right, just the way workstations are set up. It's been more about manipulating what's here and making recommendations for minor adjustments, like getting a stand for a monitor to sit on, than undertaking a major overhaul, Glasgow said. And it helps with retention because the employees feel like they're valued. Generally, a one-on-one assessment of an office worker who's experiencing discomfort may take an average of 30 minutes, Smith explained. For an industrial operator, an ergo assessment may take a couple of hours per job, and an overall workplace assessment usually requires a couple of days. In ergonomics, the best posture is your next posture, and you can overcome a lot of bad situations by making sure you keep moving, Smith said. The risk factors we want people to look at, like awkward posture and repetition, are basically the same in office, industrial, and manufacturing. Obviously, the repetition of someone doing heavy lifting in a warehouse is different than somebody typing, but we're still looking at, are you in an awkward posture? Are you doing something that's creating discomfort? One of her universal recommendations is to take micro breaks, 30 to 90 seconds, once or twice an hour. Somebody who's been using a jackhammer is going to need a little more time than that, but in most office environments, those small micro breaks are fantastic, Smith said. And they don't just give your muscles a chance to recover, they also give you a mental break. Although she's encountered some managers who balk at the idea of encouraging micro breaks, she believes it helps workers be more productive because they can avoid fatigue and can refocus. Being able to stand up and stretch, get the muscles moving in your back, is very beneficial, Smith said. To help workers remember to take those moments, she suggests simple workplace modifications. moving the printer across the room, placing the trash can in another room, even putting the cell phone out of reach so answering a text requires standing up and moving. Tamara James, who was director of the ergonomic program in the Division of Occupational and Environmental Medicine at the Duke University School of Medicine for roughly 30 years, has been Smith's mentor for decades. Since Smith joined her team as a student intern while pursuing a degree in industrial engineering at NC State University, James, who retired from her full-time role in 2020 but continues as a consulting ergonomist, sees a couple of concerning ergonomic trends. Since COVID led so many people to work from home, what we have now are some silent wounded, people who are having pain or discomfort but don't want to complain about their home office setup because then they'll have to go back to the office to work, James said. Another concerning aspect is the hybrid return to office that has spawned the hot desking or hoteling movement where employees use whatever desks or workstations are available rather than having an assigned space. The problem is now you've got workstations that are supposed to be designed for everyone, but they aren't, James said. Project Life exists to shed light on executive health and worker wellness. The series includes regular articles on worker stress, work anxiety, depression, and addiction-related issues that creep into the workplace and personality features from executives that are on the forefront of this fight for better health in our workplaces. The town of Morrisville is to break ground on a new town center project. This article by Kaylee Thompson. Morrisville is about to break ground on a project designed to create a vibrant downtown area as the town looks to keep up with the growth happening in other Wake County communities. Deputy Town Manager Brandon Zwidema said the town and its development partner, Sing Development, will start construction later this summer on its 25-acre town center project. The town is now finalizing the permitting process. Work will begin feverishly after that to get this project moving along, Zwidema said. The town center will be bordered by Town Hall Drive, Jeremiah Street, Church Street, and Carolina Street. Morrisville is looking to keep pace with neighboring communities such as Cary, where the downtown area has become a destination spot. Elsewhere, Holly Springs is redeveloping its downtown and also weighing the creation of a sports and entertainment district. And in Orange County, Carrboro is looking to update its downtown. Mark Spagnoli, director of engineering for Morrisville, said the town will go out to bid for a contractor in July. Once a contractor is secured, Phase 1A will be able to start with an anticipated opening in summer of 2027. The town center concept is critically important to Morrisville in terms of developing a downtown and really a destination that may not currently exist. But when Mark coming up with the concept of this district that incorporates these other existing or future amenities makes it even more attractive and a larger area with more opportunity for visitors from outside the community and certainly our own residents and other stakeholders to come, Zwidema said. The town center project has been in the works for years. Back in 2020, the overall price of the development was estimated at $57 million. Phase 1A will include the multifamily building, commercial building, town green, cottage retail, other amenities, and infrastructure improvements. Sing Development, with offices in Cary and Michigan, will start work on the multifamily and commercial buildings, while the town will work on the town green, cottage retail, and other pieces. The multifamily building will have 254 units, and the commercial building will be 10,000 square feet. The town green will be about 4 acres with a lawn, stage, education garden, pavilion and outdoor classroom, entry plaza, playground, and interactive public art. The cottage retail will be 8 units, each 1,250 square feet surrounding the town green. Zwidema said the town will also perform infrastructure improvements, including extending Fox Glove Drive to Town Hall Drive, improving Carolina Street from Fox Glove Drive to Church Street, building a connector street from Carolina Street to Jeremiah Street, and adding more parking. Spagnoli said the town will also create a town center district with amenities such as a wetland water feature, a playground, a veterans memorial, and a dog park. A popular brewery expands to Creedmoor. New Zinc House Winery to open in spot that dates to 1954. This article also by Ben Tobin. A popular brewery and event space outside Durham is looking to add a microbrewery in a small city. Zinc House Winery, LLC, which is tied to Mike Tenover, owner of Zinc House Winery and Brewery at 6225 Wake Forest Highway east of Durham, has applied for a special use permit to operate out of a roughly 70-year-old building at 105 Fleming Street in Creedmoor. Tenover said that Creedmoor is the perfect location for Zinc House Winery and Brewery to set up our brewing operations and ultimately a brew pub. Originally, we had planned to brew all of our beer at our Durham location, but discovered that expanding our septic system to accommodate all the brewing activities was cost prohibitive, Tenover said. We were fortunate to find and purchase a beautiful old building in downtown Creedmoor that had the water and sewer capacity needed to brew our beer. Tenover said the new location in Creedmoor is 11 miles from the Durham location, making it easy to transport beer. He said that once final permitting is complete, the brewing operation should be up and running in 2 to 3 months. The full build-out for the brew pub will likely take around 9 months to a year. Tenover purchased the building, a 12,000-square-foot property built in 1954 that previously housed the Granville Milling Company, for $500,000 in November 2023, according to deed records. He said they will need to do quite a bit of work on the building before opening the brew pub, including adding insulation to the exterior of the building and cladding the exterior with new zinc metal roof and siding. He added that the building includes beautiful exposed beams all over the interior. Tenover declined to share the estimated cost of the upfit. He said the space will definitely be a showpiece when we're finished and a place that Creedmoor can be proud of. Tenover and his wife Kimberly opened Zinc House Winery and Brewery on more than 80 acres near the Falls Village Golf Course in 2022. The business is open to the general public Wednesday through Sunday and hosts tastings, events, and live music. Many entry-level jobs in the Triangle fall short for pay. A new wave of employees is entering the workforce following high school and college graduations, but half of them won't make a living wage in the Triangle. That's according to a new analysis by online lender NetCredit of data from the MIT Living Wage Calculator and job postings from Indeed.com. The analysis looked at the cost of living for one adult without children in the 100 largest metro areas to determine the percentage of entry-level jobs that paid a living wage. For the Raleigh-Durham metro, the hourly living wage comes to $25.86. For the Durham-Chapel Hill area, the number dips to $24.87. In both areas, about 50% of job postings had wages above the local living wage. The big number this week, $45 billion. That's the U.S. cannabis market revenue for 2020.